The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. It's really great to be here, and I love to come to libraries. And we used to be a trustee at the Nantucket Athenaeum, which is our local library that underwent a very important renovation project about 15 years ago that just, you know, changed all of downtown. And I started this tour at the Boston Public Library, so it's really great to be here in Philadelphia. So thanks for having me. Now, long before I moved to Nantucket Island and began writing books about the sea, I was a 14-year-old high school freshman in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was then that I saw the movie Little Big Man. Now, if you've seen Little Big Man, you know it's all about Custer, the deranged maniac as Custer, and it just fascinated me, and I've been interested in that story ever since. And it was while finishing my previous book, Mayflower, which tells the story that many Americans look to as the iconic beginning of America, which in my telling ends with a climactic and cataclysmic English native conflict known as King Philip's War. It was after writing Mayflower that I said, okay, so that this is the icon with which American history is thought to begin. Where does it lead? Well, it leads to the Battle of Little Bighorn. It leads to what I began thinking about with Little Big Man. And so 4 years ago, I began going out to the West on a regular basis. I've now been to the battlefield 5 times. And it's been fascinating for me. In my previous books, I've argued that Americans are infatuated with a sense of a wilderness. It's how we define ourselves as Americans, the frontier. And for most of us, it's the West. Lewis and Clark, cowboys and Indians. That's what America is all about. But in my previous books, I say, wait a minute, before there was the West, there was the wilderness of the sea. Right through the first half of the 19th century, that's what defined so much of America. And so it was very interesting for me to then say, okay, I've been talking about the sea. Let's see what it's like west. And instead of a departure, I found it to be a kind of culmination, because what America was doing as it marched west under the banner of manifest destiny into the 19th century was part of a global process, just as Nantucket whalers were heading out into the far reaches of the Atlantic and the Pacific, literally taking America's first global economy everywhere. So were we working our way across our own continent. And, you know, it's colonization was going on in Africa, India, the Middle East. But it's different here in America, given that we were going across where we now live today. And as a consequence, we're still living with the consequences of that process. And I've become convinced that the Battle of Little Bighorn did not end on June 25th, 1876. Now, evidence is a huge part of the story. It was a historic event even before it ended. Officers such as Custer's underling Major Marcus Reno and Captain Frederick Benteen were already calculating how to put their actions in the best possible light. And even though there was a court of inquiry several years after the battle into Major Reno's behavior, it's clear that the officers were told to do nothing to impugn the honor of the regiment. And so you look at that much of that testimony is very helpful, but it's only limited in how it goes. Everyone under Custer's battalion was killed, 210 men. And yet there were plenty of Lakota and Cheyenne survivors of the battle. Their testimony has been recorded in many instances, but this too has to be taken with caution, because there's inevitably an interpreter involved who had his own agenda, and often it was a military officer who was interviewing them, and there's a tendency to tell your interviewer what you want to hear, particularly if you fear repercussions. And so what has surprised me is how much seeing has defined my research and ultimately the writing of this book, not only going to the battlefield and investigating the terrain, but native pictographs of the battle, historical photographs in which you can... Usually, I don't have photographs in my previous books to rely on, and I will be showing you a slideshow later on that is based on a research trip I took beginning on the Standing Rock Sioux Agency, where Sitting Bull would end up in the years after the battle, which is right on the border of North and South Dakota on the Missouri River. I then would go to Fort Lincoln, where the 7th Cavalry was stationed prior to the battle, and follow their path west, more than 300 miles, into south-central Montana, where Custer would rendezvous with the Far West, a 190-foot riverboat, would have his last strategic meeting with the other officers on this column. Custer had gotten into political hot water in the months prior to the battle. He had testified before a Senate committee looking into corruption in the Grant administration and fingered Grant's younger brother, Orville. Presidents always seem to have a younger brother who gets them into trouble. And Grant was infuriated by this, tried to strip Custer of his command in the upcoming campaign, finally relented. He was at least allowed to go, but General Alfred Terry was put in charge, an older man, used to a desk job, and so Custer was under a cloud when this began, and he would have his last meeting with Terry aboard the Far West at the confluence of the Rosebud and Yellowstone rivers before heading out, and 3.5 days later, the Battle of Little Bighorn would begin. Custer's timing was exquisite. Word would be delivered by the Far West to Bismarck, North Dakota, on July 6th, the next day, just a few days after America had celebrated the centennial of its glorious birth. Just with the Civil War behind it, America seemed on the verge of finally winning the West. They hear that one of America's foremost Indian fighters has been wiped out to a man. And it's sort of like, I liken it to, and I'm not the first, liken it to the news of the Titanic. How could this happen? Well, we've been trying to figure it out ever since. And because everyone died under Custer, a mystery hovers over this story, a mystery that will keep bringing us back time and time again. And I think every generation, when it returns to this story, will see something slightly different. Now, the Battle of Little Bighorn is three battles in one. Custer assumed he could not see the village as he was approaching it. Terrain is a big part of the story. And the village was on beside the Little Bighorn River, surrounded by bluffs, and they could see smoke and evidence of a huge pony herd, as many as 20,000 horses, but they could not see the village directly until they were almost upon it. Custer, military officers at this time did not fear the size of a village. They feared that it would disperse before they could attack it, and Custer's scouts had led him to believe that that's what was happening. In anticipation of this, he divided his command, sending Frederick Benteen to the left, sending Major Marcus Reno down with his own battalion down the Little Bighorn River to charge into the village of unknown size as Custer swung right up into the bluffs. Custer would probably be the first to see the village, and he couldn't believe it. Instead of running, a huge village, a village that would turn out to be about 8,000 Lakota and Cheyenne. Remember, his regiment amounted to 650 officers and men divided into three battalions. He saw this huge village, and instead of being a little concerned, took off his hat, a messenger who would then go to Frederick Benteen tells us, took off his hat, waved it exultantly in the air, and said, "We've got them sleeping in their teepees. Onward." As Reno's battalion was going down the valley, they could see Custer up there on the bluffs, but he would disappear behind an intervening bluff and never to be seen again alive. Reno would, instead of charging into the village, would stop, throw out a skirmish line, allowing the warriors of Sitting Bull's village to collect themselves, launch their own attack, which sent Reno scurrying up into the bluffs to the south, where he was rejoined by Benteen, who had gotten a message to come on quick from Custer. Instead of coming on quick, Benteen hung out with Reno for an hour or so before one of his officers shamed him into proceeding to the north, towards where they knew there must be fighting, even though Benteen and Reno would insist later that they never heard anything. They would see smoke, dust, and then they would see a huge number of Indians coming back towards them. Thus would begin a two-day siege, which is one of the great sieges of the American West. They would be rescued by General Terry, who would arrive from the north. And 2.5 days after Custer died, around what we now call Last Stand Hill, they would find the bodies of those 210 men, and thus would begin the mystery. I call this book The Last Stand because everyone knows about Custer's Last Stand. This victory was also the beginning of the last stand for the Lakota and Cheyenne, within a few years would all be on the reservations, except for Sitting Bull, who remained in exile for several years in Canada, but he too would eventually surrender to the authorities and end up on the Standing Rock Sioux Agency. And I think it's impossible to understand the Little Bighorn unless we put it in the context of this other last stand. Now, before I go to the slides, or the PowerPoint, as we now get into this technologically advanced age, I'd like to read a passage from my book. This is from the preface, and just to set it up, Custer is known to us today as history's biggest loser because he lost at the Little Bighorn. The fact of the matter is, in the Civil War, he was one of our greatest cavalry officers. General Sheridan would give Custer's wife, Libby, they were married during the Civil War, give the table upon which the Appomattox Treaty was signed and tell her no officer deserves this more than your gallant husband. Custer finished last in his class at West Point, but ended up as a major general, as a brevet rank. So he was demoted. He became a lieutenant colonel after the Civil War when the army was downsized. But what to do? Custer loved battle. He romanticized it. He would write to one of his friends, "If I could have a battle every day, I would be happy." But it all ended. And he eventually would be given command of the 7th Cavalry, stationed in Kansas, in the rolling plains of Kansas. And in the initial campaign, the Cheyenne were making a mockery of his attempts to subdue them. And this scene begins on the Kansas plains. Custer is going along. Custer was flamboyant. He had his own pack of English greyhounds. And when his English greyhounds see some antelope and take off in pursuit, he can't help but leave the column and follow them. He's completely swallowed up and lost in these green plains. And it's then that he sees his first buffalo. As he tells us in his My Life on the Plains, he will see hundreds of thousands of these creatures, but none as large as this. So he takes off in pursuit. In the 2 years since Lee's surrender at Appomattox, Custer had come to long for the battlefield. Only amid the smoke, blood, and confusion of war had his fidgety and ambitious mind found peace. But now, in the spring of 1867, as his trusted horse galloped to within shooting range of the buffalo, he began to feel some of the old, wild joy. Amid the beat of hooves and the bellows-like suck and blast of air through his horse's nostrils emerged the transcendent presence of the buffalo, ancient, vast, and impossibly strong in its thundering charge across the infinite plains. He couldn't help but shout with excitement. As he drew close, he held out his pearl-handled pistol and started to plunge the barrel into the dusty funk of the buffalo's fur, only to withdraw the weapon so as to, in his own words, prolong the enjoyment of the race. After several more minutes of pursuit, he decided it was finally time for the kill. Once again, he pushed the gun into the creature's pelt. As if sensing Custer's intentions, the buffalo abruptly turned toward the horse. It all happened in an instant. The horse veered away from the buffalo's horns, and when Custer tried to grab the reins with both hands, his finger accidentally pulled the trigger and fired a bullet into the horse's head, killing him instantly. Custer had just enough time to disengage his feet from the stirrups before he was catapulted over the neck of the collapsing animal.
He tumbled onto the ground, struggled to his feet, and faced his erstwhile prey. Instead of charging, the buffalo simply stared at this strange, outlandish creature and stalked off. Horseless and alone in Indian country, except for his panting dogs, George Custer began the long and uncertain walk back to his regiment.
Well, that foretells a lot. Now, let's go to the slides. I learned about Custer at the movies. I think a lot of us did. This is where my parents learned about Custer. Errol Flynn in They Died With Their Boots On. A great movie. And in fact, its portrayal of Custer in his West Point years is surprisingly accurate. But that's about it. This was done just as America was steeling itself for the approaching World War. And so this is Custer as patriotic, true blue, a man of charisma and integrity. This is my Custer, the Custer of Little Big Man, a deranged maniac. 1970, we were trying to get out of Vietnam, the Vietnam War, and Custer, a cultural lightning rod, even when he was alive, you either loved him or you hated him. As an icon, he gets reinterpreted with the times. And this was actually, this portion of the movie was filmed on the battlefield in what's now Medicine Tail Coulee. And one of the sort of late-breaking pieces of evidence related to the battle is that in 1983, fire swept across the battlefield. And the superintendent used this as an opportunity to bring in an archaeological team who did an extensive study and came up with all sorts of ballistic and forensic evidence found, you know, this is the CSI phase of Custer research. And every rifle puts a signature into a cartridge that can be traced, and they were able to following the cartridges, be able to follow the progress of a specific warrior or a specific trooper across the battlefield. Just fascinating. In this portion of the battlefield, they found very little of historic nature, but they found plenty of cartridges from the filming of Little Big Man. This is George Custer, a newly graduated West Point. From West Point, he's on his way into history. He is on his way to the Civil War. He stopped in New York. It's a hot summer day. You can see how his collar has wilted. And he's posing for a photograph to send back to the family. He would be the Forrest Gump of the Civil War. He'd be there at Bull Run. He would be at just about every major battle in the Eastern Theater. And 2 years after finishing last in his class, he would be a brigadier general at Gettysburg. This is Custer at the end of the war. I mean, look at this guy. I mean, his best friend in life was a Shakespearean actor named Lawrence Barrett, and Custer was an actor in his own right. And he's got his two stars there. He's got his gauntlets, his boots, his distinctive red tie, which he'd bring with him out into the West. But and notice how his face has been. He was blue-eyed, blonde-haired. Hats were absolutely essential to his survival, not only during the Civil War, but particularly out west. And notice how his cheeks have been tanned and crisped by the wind. This is Custer 9 years later. He has now reinvented himself as Custer of the West, the Indian fighter. A mountain man's scruffiness has sprouted on his cheeks. He's dressed in buckskin. He's got his dog surrounded by his dogs. His favorite Arikara Scout bloody knife is crouched beside him, pointing to the map spread out on his knees. The rifle he will carry into his last battle is there beside him. And this is the Black Hills Expedition of 1874, led by Custer. And really, the Battle of Little Bighorn begins here. The supposed aim of this battle, this expedition, was to find a potential site for a fort in the Black Hills, Lakota land, their holiest of holies. Custer also happened to bring along some gold prospectors who discovered gold.
America was reeling from an economic panic, the panic of 1873. The government, there was a debt, national debt of $2 billion, a huge amount at that time. As had been proven true in California and the Rockies, there's nothing like discovering gold to bring back the economy. 10,000 miners were soon in the Black Hills. What to do? This was Lakota land. The Grant administration decided, well, the Lakota must sell. In the winter, the fall of 1875, they did everything they could to convince them to do it. They refused. And by that winter, Grant had decided the only alternative was to bring the Lakota, who were not on the reservations, in and force them to sell. And so Custer, the Little Bighorn, was part of a campaign not to defend innocent pioneer families. Montana was legal hunting grounds for the Lakota and Cheyenne. There were no forts out there, no ranches. There was nothing. This was a tawdry little war to accomplish, to fill America's coffers. This is Sitting Bull, his great iconic opponent. Sitting Bull would be the last of his tribe to surrender in 1881. He would be put under arrest and kept at Fort Randall for more than a year on the Missouri River in today's South Dakota. Eventually, he would be allowed to return to his people in Standing Rock, and he would riverboat would transport him, and during that voyage, they'd stop, and this photograph was taken. Notice the butterfly in his hat. This is a pictograph by Sitting Bull. He did several dozen of these, portraying his battle honors in his youth. This is an incident where a one-on-one encounter with a Crow chief when he was 25 years old. He's the one with the blue shield that was made by his father, Jumping Bull. And you can see his glyph up there, the sort of personal logo of the buffalo. And both are armed, both are shooting at each other. Sitting Bull would prevail, kill the chief, but not until after suffering a bullet wound to the foot, and he would limp for the rest of his life. This is his nephew, White Bull, who would be at the Little Bighorn and many years later in the 1930s be interviewed by the Walter Campbell, who under the pen name Stanley Vestal would write a biography of Sitting Bull. And the transcripts of those interviews are at the University of Oklahoma. This is his brother, One Bull, probably the more spiritual of the two. He, too, would talk to Vestal. And his accounts tend to focus on sort of the spiritual and visionary aspects of his uncle's activities in the 19th century. Sitting Bull would, about a week before the battle, during a sun dance along the Rosebud River, would have a vision in which he saw soldiers upside down falling into a Lakota camp, which was seen as anticipating a great Lakota victory. Now, this is just to orient you on the research trip I took. Beginning on the right with a red line, that's the Standing Rock Sioux Agency on the Missouri. Made our way up to Fort Lincoln, which is just downriver from Bismarck. And then we started west, following Custer's trail into Montana. They would make it to the Powder River. Now, it's counterintuitive, but the rivers in this area, the tributaries to the Yellowstone flows northeast. The tributaries, such as the Powder River, the Little Bighorn, the Bighorn, all flow north into the Yellowstone. And so Custer's column would make it to the Powder, follow the Powder down to the Yellowstone, where they met up with the Far West, and then eventually to the confluence of the Rosebud, and then would begin the three-day march towards Sitting Bull. This is Mobridge on the Missouri River, very near a Sitting Bull memorial. Sitting Bull's cabin in Standing Rock was on the Grand River, which is a trip flows into the Missouri. And my intrepid researcher Mike Hill and I would, with the guidance of Marge Shoots the Enemy, would set off to down a very long and a bumpy road towards the site of Sitting Bull's cabin. We almost made it. Unfortunately, they did not have a four-wheel drive vehicle at the Hertz Rent-A-Car in Bismarck, so we had a very inappropriate vehicle for this. You can see we almost made it. See those trees there? That is the Grand River, so we were almost there. And we are avoiding this mud puddle only to find ourselves in another one. And this gave me a very good and necessary education into the nature of the mud in the northern plains. The alkaline mud is like nothing you see on the East Coast. It's slippery, incredibly sticky. And it made a mockery of our attempts at trying to push the car out. Custer, when they left Fort Lincoln, would be besieged day after day of rain, and they would just had to slog through this mud. And then I also learned about the power of the great plain of the north of the sun, because within an hour or two of frantic flailing, things had dried out enough that we were able to finally get the car out. Thank goodness. This is a replica of Custer's residence at Fort Lincoln. It's built on the original foundation. He and Libby lived here with their servants. They were a childless couple, and it would be in May of 1876 that the regiment would leave and head west to its first camping site on the Heart River, just 11 miles from Fort Lincoln. And since it was so close, Custer brought along Libby and his sister Maggie, who was married to Lieutenant Calhoun, one of his officers, and it was here on the flat section beside the river that the regiment camped. You can see where this is the direction that they then proceeded on the next day. By this time, Libby and Maggie had been sent back to Fort Lincoln, and Custer proceeded on. Now, just the year before, there had been a picnic Custer had brought along many of the officers of the 7th Cavalry right in the same place in the Heart River. And I wanted to show you this because I think there's a lot of very interesting body language here. Custer is in the white buckskin suit with his arms crossed looking away. That's Libby seated to his right. And see that very handsome guy in the black? That is Captain Miles Keough. And at one point, Custer admonished Libby for writing to Miles Keough. And, you know, who knows what's going on there, but I think there's something going on. Custer's jealousy did not prevent him from being a serial womanizer of his own. They were the ultimate power couple. They were both committed to making Custer a great American hero. And Libby would take that into overdrive after Custer's death, and she'd live into the 1930s, and making sure all the time that her husband was remembered in the best possible light. Most of the men you see here will die at the Battle of Little Bighorn. To the far right, under that very wide-brimmed hat, is Custer's brother Tom. Seated just a little bit to the left with those incredible sideburns is Lieutenant Cook, Custer's adjutant. Moving over to the left, seated with a stubby top hat, is Boston Custer, Custer's brother, and his brother-in-law, Lieutenant James Calhoun, is seated on the far left. And five members of Custer's family would die at the Battle of Little Bighorn. We proceeded west. This is typical of the country you see along here. It was a very wet spring in 2007, as it was in 1876. So this green that you see here would have been true 134 years ago. We arrived at the badlands of the Little Missouri River. Not far from here, Theodore Roosevelt had a cabin, which is you can still see. And it was thought that Sitting Bull might be on the Little Missouri. So Custer led a 50-mile scout up the Missouri, Little Missouri, but they found nothing. They proceeded west, and as they were approaching the Powder River, they encountered this very jagged country that you see here. And Terry feared that they weren't going to be able to get the wagons through. And he looked to Custer, who had a talent when it came to trailblazing, and they made it through to the Powder. This is the Powder. It's aptly named. It is a very silty river, they say, too thick to drink, not thick enough to plow. And this is the vicinity where the regiment camped. And then Custer would proceed north down the Powder to the Yellowstone. And this is the Yellowstone. It's a magnificent river. That's an island right in the middle of it there. It's to this day one of the more pristine rivers. There are no dams messing it up. It was here that they rendezvoused with the Far West, a 190-foot riverboat. Without this riverboat, they could not have fought Sitting Bull. It provided them with ammunition, with provisions. One of these boats, when it was going against the current, these were very powerful steam-driven boats, could go through 30 cords of wood in a day. Can you imagine the havoc they made to the trees along the river? Notice the spars on the bow. When the Far West encountered a shoal, a sandbank, they would swing these spars over the ahead of the bow, drive the bottom of two of them into the bottom, and using the capstans that you can see near the bow, which were steam-powered, they would winch the bow up as the stern wheel drove this 190-foot riverboat over the sandbar. It looked so much like an insect on its spindly legs lurching over the sandbars that this was known as grasshoppering, a true invasive species of empire. This is Mitch Boyer. He was the Crow interpreter, and without Mitch, Custer would have never found the village. Mitch was born a Lakota, but married a Crow woman and aligned himself with his wife's people. The Crows had allied themselves with the U.S. government because they feared that the Lakota, who had been encroaching from the east for decades, might take their land. So they viewed this alliance as a way to keep their land. And I think Mitch's headgear those are two blue jays, stellar jays actually, are a wonderful, this is a piece of headgear for someone who is caught between two warring peoples. This is a very complex situation out west. We began following Custer's trail up the Rosebud River. You can see it's not a big waterway. Acting as our guide was Jim Court, a former superintendent of the battlefield. We stopped here. This you can see, this is where Custer's first stop, just a little over 10 miles from where they began at the confluence of the Rosebud and Yellowstone. And we proceeded on. And it was here that Jim pulled the car over and said, "Look at that one-room structure over there." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Look closer." Okay, now I don't know if you can see it, but see what it says? Philbrick School, 1928 to 1934. I said, "What? I had no idea that they were Philbrick." We then talked to a rancher whose property you'll see in a little bit, who said, "Yeah, you know, in the years after the Little Bighorn, there were three families that moved into the Rosebud River Valley, and one of them were the Philbricks. They had sheep." I tell you, this book was like a vortex, channeling all sorts of things. This is the second place where Custer stopped, and you can see the terrain begins to change here. That string of trees there and brush is the Rosebud River. The waterfall out there is so small that the only place you find trees is beside a river. But you can also see how the land begins to change. The hills begin to move towards you as you work your way south. This is the ranch of John Bailey, and he owns the property where Sitting Bull's Sundance occurred, where he had that great vision. And sort of across from that, on John's land, are the Deer Medicine Rocks, which are holy to the Lakota and Cheyenne, and are etched with petroglyphs that, according to the Cheyenne, they called these the rock writing bluffs. And it was said that the petroglyphs on them would change with time, and would actually, you could see events in the future on these rocks. And here's a sample of what you find on there. We continued on into the northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation, following the Rosebud up, and it was near the modern town of Busby on the reservation that the Lakota Trail veered to the west, turned right from the Rosebud, and went up into what are called the Wolf Mountains, a divide. And it was in the Wolf Mountains on what was called the Crow's Nest that on the morning of June 25th, 1876, the Crow Scouts saw evidence of the huge pony herd and smoke coming up from the Little Bighorn Valley. And this indicated to them that there was a huge gathering of Lakota and Cheyenne down there. It took Custer a while to become convinced, but he too eventually began to realize that there was that. His hope was initially to wait a day, but they were discovered by some Lakota and Cheyenne, and they felt they had no alternative but to go for it. And so the morning of June 25th, 2007, we got up very early and with Jim's guidance made our way into the to the divide. And instead of the clear blue sky that greeted the Crow Scouts, we got fog worthy of my native Nantucket. But I am here looking in, but you can sort of see the country, and we're looking towards the Little Bighorn Valley, which is the site of the village is 15 miles away. Here's I took this photo at the battlefield. That's what's known as Last Stand Hill. That's the monument, Custer Monument. And there, surrounded by a fence, are 40 or so graves of the officers and soldiers found in the vicinity of Custer, clustered there. Dying not far from Custer were his brother Tom and his brother Boston and his 18-year-old nephew, Audie Reed. I'm standing to the west with my back towards the Little Bighorn and the Little Bighorn Valley, where the village was located. And this is just an amazing landscape. When you're up on the bluffs looking out into the valley, it is the most eerie and spiritual place I've ever been. I've been there five times now, and every time I get there, it's as if I've never seen it before. It has such a power. Now, when we were there, there was a reenactment. There's an annual reenactment around the anniversary of the battle on the Real Bird family land. The Real Birds are a Crow family that own the land where the Lakota and Cheyenne village was located. And here you can see the bandstands. And this shows you that's the Yellowstone River. Notice how it winds. Every spring, when it's infused with snow melt and rain, it often jumps its borders. So it's a changing river. And we're looking on the other side of that cut bank that over there is general direction of Last Stand Hill. This is a picture of the reenactment. The writing skills, particularly of the Northern Cheyenne, were just incredible. This is a pictograph by Amos Badheart Bull of a scene from the Battle of Little Bighorn. That's Crazy Horse in the center, in the midst of the battle. These are much more than just wonderful pictures. There's all sorts of detailed information there that, given the ambiguous nature of much of the written testimony, I think take on special relevance. And this is the unheralded hero of the Battle of Little Bighorn, from my perspective. This is Yellow Nose. He was a Cheyenne, and this is called ledger art. The warriors would often draw their battle honors or coups on the pages of a ledger book. And this shows Yellow Nose. He's taken the guidon, the flag, from the flag bearer, and he is now counting coup. He's tapping the flag bearer with it, even as the flag bearer shoots at him. This was remarked by many warriors at the battle as one of the bravest things done during the battle. And Yellow Nose would finally make his way to Last Stand Hill and has an account. He thought he was confronting perhaps Custer. It was probably his brother Tom, because Yellow Nose says that he had a red and yellow bandana that Tom was wearing. And it's kind of ironic, because Yellow Nose would kill Tom, and Tom got two Congressional Medals of Honor for taking the flag from Confederate flag bearers during the Civil War. This is Wooden Leg's pictograph of ripping a carbine from a trooper. This is after the reenactment. They're watering their horses on the Little Bighorn River, and that's Steve Alexander with the white hat and the red tie, one of the foremost Custer reenactors in the country. He lives in Monroe, Michigan, where Custer and Libby called home. And it's also the birthplace of the Lazy Boy recliner. This is another view of the river. This is Bad Heart Bull once again showing Reno's retreat across the river. When Reno retreated, he made no attempt to cover the retreat of his men. And as a consequence, the Lakota and Cheyenne were free to do as they wanted. They compared it to a buffalo hunt. And it was particularly bad at the river, which acted as a bottleneck. And this scene, I think, brings it to life in a way that any other account just cannot do justice to it. I took this picture from the approximate position of Reno skirmish line, looking towards what's called Weir's Peak, named for one of the officers that was with Reno and Benteen. And it was from this peak that they saw probably the very end of Custer's last stand and then fled to the south where the siege would eventually occur. And this is a picture of me in the vicinity of Weir Peak. It was my second time on a horse. I have immense respect for horses. This was Tomcat, 27-year-old former rodeo horse. It's my intrepid researcher, Mike Hill, behind. If you look in the distance, you can see, so it looks like a grove of trees. That's where the interpretive center is for the battlefield. Charlie Realbird, a Crow tribal member, took this picture. He was leading us in a ride across the battlefield, and we would proceed south towards the location of Reno's siege. Now, in addition to horses, heights make me uncomfortable, and the trail took us to the edge of a precipice that went straight down to the river. It seemed to me about 2,000 feet down. I was a little dismayed to learn that it was only 300 feet, but it's just beautiful country. And you can just see how it meanders through the hills. And this is really a mini mountain range that then flattens out to the spine of hills where Custer met his death. The next day, I like boats, so I got on a motorboat, and I made my way up the Bighorn River. I wanted to retrace the Far West's voyage, because after that final meeting of the officers, Captain Grant Marsh, one of the legendary riverboat pilots, took the Far West up the Bighorn River to the confluence with the Little Bighorn. This is the Little Bighorn. See that tiny waterway? That's it. Can you imagine getting a 190-foot boat there and even turning it around? I mean, it's just an amazing feat of seamanship, if we can call it that. Now, they were there waiting for first word of what had happened to Custer. Would be delivered by the Crow scout, Curley. They expected to hear of a great victory. Curley was weeping, exhausted, and unable to speak English. They were unable to speak Crow. Curley was given a pencil and paper, and on the deck of the Far West drew two concentric circles, filling them with dots. "Sioux, Sioux, Sioux," he said on the outer one. And then he made it clear that it was Custer's squadron in the center. Curley had been with Custer until Mitch Boyer told him to get out of there. And from a distant peak, he claims, saw the end of Custer's battalion. And so from then on, they knew that instead of a great victory, it had been a great defeat. This is not a priest. This is Private Peter Thompson, who was 22 years old at the time of the battle. He should have died with Custer, but his horse gave out. And he proceeded on foot. And 38 years later would write an account in which he claimed to see Custer all alone on his horse Vic by the river just a half hour before the final battle would begin. And his account was no one knew quite what to make of it. Many scholars have dismissed it, even mocked it.
But in recent decades, more and more seemingly outlandish details from it have been corroborated by other accounts. I was granted access to an unpublished manuscript written by Thompson's daughter, in which she quotes from a notebook he began to keep just months after the battle. And so it turned out his account, it seems very authentic to me in terms of how the process of memory and the confusion of battle. It means that when he wrote his account, it was based on memories recorded right after the battle, rather than being the distant memories of an old man. Thompson's account has all sorts of issues, but I think I use it as a way to talk about evidence and the Battle of Little Bighorn. And finally, I'd like to leave you with this image. This is a Lakota bull boat. All it took were some willow branches and one buffalo hide from a male buffalo to make a bull boat. And the Lakota used these vessels to cross rivers that the U.S. cavalry thought were impassable. And for me, this image is emblematic of the continuities I've found between the wilderness of the West and the wilderness of the sea. The Lakota interpreter Billy Garnett said the Lakota believed that the first white man came from the sea. The sea was also home to another predator, the shark. And Garnett said that a word of warning, Wamunitu, that they would use whenever their children were swimming in a river to get out, came from the Indians of the East Coast, where sharks would threaten their children. And I've often wondered if Wamunitu was used, was shouted out when the first bullets began to fly, because many Lakota children were swimming in the Little Bighorn River when Reno first attacked. And, you know, in the months before the battle, Sitting Bull was quoted as saying, "We are an island of Indians in a lake of whites." On June 25, 26, against all odds, Sitting Bull's island of Lakota and Cheyenne somehow managed to prevail against the shark-infested sea. Thank you very much. Now, I'd be happy to try to answer your questions, and if you have, any of you have any questions, someone will bring a microphone to you, and go ahead. Any questions?
I see in the movie Portrayal, I think, that the Indians were using arrows as well as carbines. Who furnished them the carbines, and were they using arrows as well?
Yeah. This is where this battle seems very modern. Part of the findings of the archaeological investigations prove that Custer's battalion was massively outgunned by the Lakota and Cheyenne. The U.S. government was trying to save as much money when it came to the military, and so it equipped the soldiers with single-shot carbines. I have fired a replica of a Springfield 73, and I can tell you from personal experience, they are very difficult to load, very powerful weapon. And if you don't have much experience with them, because they did not allow much target practice because they were trying to save money, this is not the weapon you want in the middle of a fight where you're being engulfed with Native warriors. I mean, Private Peter Thompson told his daughter that he was scared spitless of his carbine. That is not the attitude you want when you go into battle. And and it was clear from the archaeology that many of the Native Americans were equipped with repeating rifles, Henry and Winchesters, that capable of firing 17 rounds at once. And so when you're in close fighting, this is a huge advantage. And they secured these at trading posts, and much of the ammunition they had was provided even at the reservations in the years prior to this. They stopped selling them in 1876. But so once again, and this just really obviously was a great concern for the army, that they were going up against, which in many cases an enemy that was better armed than they were. Yes.
Could you give us some background on the Gatling gun, which was available during that battle, but
yes,
was not used?
Yeah. Thank you. That's a great question. This battle is full of what ifs. what if, Reno and Benteen had come to his aid? The biggest what if concerns the Gatling gun. Custer was given the option of a Gatling gun. Was invented around during the Civil War. It was a huge machine gun, a cannon-sized machine gun that was towed by two horses, and this was extraordinarily effective if you could get it to where you were fighting. The problem was transporting the Gatling gun, and prior to the battle, Reno had gone on a scout with the Gatling gun in tow, and they had had a miserable time trying to transport it. And at one point, they even just left it for a while. And so Custer, going into this battle, knew he had to move quickly and feared that the Gatling gun would hold him back. He also declined an extra company or two of cavalry, saying, if we can't handle it, nobody can. And so, if he had had this, and as it turned out, the pack train that they used was so cumbersome and so slow, they probably definitely could have brought the Gatling gun with them. So, if they had had the Gatling gun, who knows? So, but the reality of it was there was no Gatling gun, and Custer's battalion was wiped out to a man.
Do we know anything about Custer's childhood, his early childhood?
Yes, Custer's childhood. Custer, it turns out, was born in New Rumley, Ohio, which is about an hour's drive from where I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's eastern Ohio, just over the border. I've visited there. I even had the pleasure of looking into the chimney that still stands of his boyhood home, that burnt down or has been torn down, but the chimney is still there. He had his father was a blacksmith who was hugely involved with the Democratic Party, and they were a family of practical jokers, and so they were always good-naturedly fighting and making fun of each other. It was just one of these brawling forms of love. And one of the anecdotes his father would tell is that when Custer was just a little kid, 7, 8 years old, he'd had his tooth extracted, and his mouth was still bloody, and he was wearing a kid's military uniform, and he looks up to his father and he says, "Dad, you and I could whip all the Republicans in Ohio, the Whigs or whatever." It was the other party at the time. And Emanuel, his father, just thought this was great. And politics, Custer had political ambitions. And every time he dabbled in them, he got into big trouble. His testimony in Washington just before. But there is testimony from the Arikara Scouts that Custer several times said to them, "If I have a victory, I will become the great father," meaning I will become president. Whether or not he actually said that, who knows? But while researching this book, I was in the archives at the Monroe Historical Society, where they have a lot of Custer family correspondence. And there was a letter written during the Civil War, just before the Lincoln's reelection. And Custer was a Democrat, but during the war he had to do everything he could to express his allegiance to Lincoln. And this infuriated his father. And so his father is berating him in this letter, "Hey, make your loyalty to the Democratic Party known, because we're going to win this election, and you have as good a chance as anyone at someday making it to the White House." Custer was 24 years old.
When all was said and done, did you end up having respect and sympathy for Custer, or did he seem to be someone who did not merit those emotions?
Custer, I found to be endlessly fascinating. He was a man who if he walked into this hall, half of us would say, "Wow, look at that guy." The other half would say, "What an egomaniacal jerk, And this was true within his own regiment. Most of the officers loved him. The two senior officers, however, Reno and Bantine, despised him. And he's known as an Indian fighter, but he also had a talent for negotiation. There was one time in Kansas where Sheridan wanted him to attack. He refused, went in at great personal risk, and talked to them and convinced them to come in. I think that this is ultimately, for me, a tragedy, this story. There were plenty of other options. Sitting Bull didn't want to fight. I was astonished to learn that when the first bullets were flying, he said to his nephew, "Go out there with my shield. Don't shoot." And so this battle didn't have to happen. Custer is someone, I spent a lot, there's parts you can love about him, parts that are just terrible. He was a glory hunter. He wanted to be remembered. And the great irony is we're talking about him today, which is exactly what he would have wanted because he suffered such a terrible defeat. Okay. One last question.
Could you talk a little bit about why you referred to him as deranged, or why some have referred to him as
right,
deranged?
Right, some have deranged. Well, if you see Little Big Man, it's Little Big Man is in the cultural milieu of the Vietnam War, and and there were a whole host of characters in the movies of that period the military guy who's lost it, and Custer of Little Big Man is there, and there were other General Sheridan, there was an aspect to Custer's behavior. He was reckless. He was incredibly physically brave. And I'll end with this quote. When Custer was married during the Civil War, and Sheridan would later say to Custer, "Custer, you are the only officer for whom marriage has not spoiled for a charge." Thank you very much.
And I don't know if you know this, but the name of our popular library here where everybody checks. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.